Howdy, everyone, and welcome back to the 305. We are now in our fifth episode covering The Third Man, and I am here today with my guest, Theron Seckington, who Hello. Was here on our first episode for Citizen Kane. And as you may remember, he is the world's foremost up-and-coming zombie film aficionado and Orson Welles enthusiast.
In training.
This movie came out in 1949. It was directed by Carol Reed, who actually has three movies in the Criterion Collection. This is the first of them.
What are the other ones?
Yeah, the other ones are Odd Man Out and The Fallen Idol. They will come much later in the collection, but they were actually his earlier works. This was his, third major film, ironically. And the cast included Joseph Cotten and Orson Welles, both from Citizen Kane, of course, and longtime best friends, as well as Alida Valli, an Italian actress who was the romantic lead, and finally a supporting role from Trevor Howard, who was a British actor who also happened to be in David Lean's Brief Encounter, another Criterion title that'll come up a lot later. So the first question I'd like to ask you, Theron, is what is your experience with this film?
This has long been one of my favorite movies, actually.
Oh,
so
okay.
I've seen it several times, and I'm looking forward to seeing this this cut. I'm interested to see if certain parts of it are subtitled or not, because I've seen it with and without, and I think it's more effective without.
Yeah, I actually usually find that movies with brief foreign languages are more effective without the subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
What makes this particular one of your favorites?
It's got a tense mystery surrounding it. I think mysteries are kind of at the basis of most good storytelling. the sort of investigation that Holly Martins launches is very credible. Like, you know, he's just a guy. He has no particular resources available to him. And he's doing the best he can with this investigation. The fact that he's in way over his head makes it pretty incredible, I think, and he doesn't let that stop him. Orson Welles gives a great performance. Joseph Cotten gives a great performance. Joseph Cotten, I think, one of the most like underutilized actors of this period. And just, you know, the lighting, the I guess it's not so much sets with this, but like the lighting, the scenery, and the music are all incredible. Every aspect of the film works together to make a just absolutely thrilling experience.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would say much the same thing. I saw this movie first in my study abroad in Prague at their film school.
It's a good place to see it.
Yeah, definitely. They showed it as I think it was like a European cinema class. So we were sort of learning film history in European cinema, and this was one of the standout pieces, and I've seen it maybe once since then, but it has been quite a while. I certainly remember it very fondly. And one of the things that we discussed a lot in class was its very unusual use of the Dutch angle camera technique, where, you know, everything's shot at sort of an odd diagonal to just sort of keep the viewer off balance in a sort of way.
Yeah, people talk about that with this movie specifically a lot, and like I said, I've seen it, you know, half a dozen times, and I've never noticed. It's sort of seamless.
Yeah,
like I'm really gonna try and look out for it, but I think a credit to the filmmakers is that you just sort of accept it when it's happening. It's just kind of part of this sort of topsy turvy world that the characters find themselves in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I'd like to say before we get to watching it on that note is there's this great quote from after the release of the film. Apparently, the camera angles really divided critical opinion. Some people loved it, some people hated it. And Carol Reed, the director, was friends with an American director named William Wyler, who's also quite famous. And after the release of the movie, Wyler sent him a spirit level with a note saying, "Carol, next time you make a picture, just put it on top of the camera, will you?"
Well, most people don't know this about Carol Reed, the same as Kenneth Branagh. One of their legs is about 15 inches shorter than the other.
Of course.
So to them, it just looks normal.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. All right. Well, and right,
with that in mind, yeah, pause this podcast, put on the Criterion Laserdisc of The Third Man, which we know you have.
You all have, yes. Unfortunately, it's been out of print for a long time. Like the
haven't the they Criterion, all actually?
No, I mean the DVD and Blu-ray as well. Yeah. It was very hard to find it for a long time. I think there might be like one recent copy. It's not available for streaming, but you can find it online for paid rental if you feel like going that route.
So when the outbreak is over, go to your library. Yes. Go get a copy for free. They'll just let you borrow one. And get ready to watch one of the best films ever made, in my opinion.
There you go. Support your libraries.
The rollicking romance of a gambling hoofer who loses his heart to a beautiful dance teacher in a merry mad chase of melody and mirth to the lilting tunes of six hit songs by Jerome Kern and Dorothy Fields, the hilarious comedy of Dick DeMoor, Helen Broderick, and Eric Blore. Spectacular production numbers, stunning beauties, and the toe-tapping magic of the king and queen of captivating rhythm, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers.
After you're done listening to this episode on The Third Man, join us next time for a Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers musical spectacle, 1936's Swing Time. Welcome back, everybody. We have just completed our viewing of The Third Man on Criterion Laserdisc number 5. And I assume the agreement is that it still holds up quite well.
It's very good.
Yeah. I'll get the only negative out of the way right off the top, I suppose, which is that for me, the audio on this disc is actually not very good. I thought maybe it was just my streaming software, but I went back and checked it afterwards, and the soundtrack is quite muffled and can make the dialogue somewhat unintelligible in certain places, so it's a good thing that we've both seen this before.
Yeah, you know, I just didn't feel that necessarily. I don't know if like the streaming somehow improves it, or it's because I know this movie so well from having seen it so many times.
Well, I can hopefully you all at home are able to find better copies of it in any case, so that you can, you know, enjoy it for all it's worth.
Everyone also kind of speaks in the front of their mouth in this movie.
Yeah, that's a good way to phrase it.
I wonder if that affects the quality. Everyone's kind of up here.
Yes, it's kinda, absolutely.
You got some old-timey radio.
Yeah, and in particular, Joseph Cotten, I would say. Plus, he's got kind of a deep voice, which just, I don't know, maybe it was specifically difficult for me. But in any case, it's very, it is very good writing and very good acting and dialogue and all that. So it's worth paying attention to it very closely. So this, I'd like to start by talking about some of the background of this movie, just because I think that that's particularly fascinating in how this movie came to be and how all of these pieces align so well. So I have some notes on the people involved in the making here, and what what struck me maybe the most while reading about all of this was that it, in a way that somewhat mirrors the storyline, the production of this movie seemed to be about old friends coming together and sort of seeing how they had changed and making something together. That's a pretty, I know I'm painting in broad strokes here, but
extremely broad. Do you think this is a movie about old friends hanging out?
No, not hanging out.
I guess in a real zoomed out way, that's probably true.
Yeah, I think,
I'm just giving you a hard time.
I'd like to refine the idea that I have, because I don't think it's total bullshit. I think, to me, one of the major themes of the story is friendship and the value of friendship and what that means to different people and how they change over time. And what I had noticed in reading about the production was that in various ways, all of these people had very long-running friendships and would, you know, they'd come together for very intense partnerships and then split away for a long time and then come back together. And, you know, for instance, one of the strongest examples is Joseph Cotten and Orson Welles.
Yeah.
And I hadn't really read much about Cotten previously for Citizen Kane, but I looked into him today and I didn't realize that he and Welles had been so close for so long. Because not only were they, you know, they met as part of their radio and theater days and then worked on Citizen Kane, but then Cotten also went on to star in Magnificent Ambersons by Welles, and was with Welles' Mercury Productions for a long time. And then in the 40s, apparently, he got an offer from David O. Selznick, who comes up a lot in these podcasts. He had to break his contract with Welles, but Welles, according to the story, Cotten came in, he told Welles he had this offer, he really wanted to do it, and so Welles just, like, without a word, reached over, took his contract, ripped it up, and said, like, you have my blessing, he can do better things for you than I can. And basically just, you know, allowed Cotten to go off and become a star in his own right. He was in some very famous movies like Gaslight, I found out. But then this production of The Third Man brought them back together, and they would continue working together over the years. And there was a great... I should mention two details. There's a great quote from Welles about Cotten that said, "You're very lucky to be tall and thin and have curly hair. You can also move about the stage without running into the furniture. But these are fringe assets, and I'm afraid you'll never make it as an actor. But as a star, I think you well might hit the jackpot." And then I discovered that when Orson Welles got married to Rita Hayworth, Cotten was actually Welles' best man at the wedding. And then much later in life, Cotten, he had a heart attack and a stroke, so he was in really poor health in 81. And it says he began years of therapy to be able to speak again after the stroke. And as he began to recover, he and Orson Welles talked on the phone each week for a couple of hours. Cotten wrote that he was strong and supportive. Whenever I used the wrong word, which was frequently, he would say, "That's a much better word, Joe. I'm going to use it." He and Welles would meet for lunch and reminisce. And when Cotten said he had written a book, Welles asked for the manuscript and read it that same night. And then later, Welles was asked what he thought of the book, and his response was gentle, witty, and self-effacing, just like Joe. "My only complaint is that it's too brief." And then Welles died the following day, before Cotten passed away. So I just thought, you know, at minimum, there's a fun parallel between this story of two friends who have clearly loved each other in the past and the real actors who were friends throughout their entire life. no matter how long they spent apart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Aside from them, I would say, do you know anything about Graham Greene, the scriptwriter?
Not a ton. I know he was like a strict Catholic, which is I guess more present in his novel. Well, not that strict because he had like dozens of affairs. So
yes,
But I understand that's a lot more present in his novels than in his screenwriting, and I wonder if that's in part due to the attitude towards Catholics in the English speaking world at the time.
Sure.
And that he was a friend of one of the Cambridge Five.
And who are they?
A ring of Soviet double agents, or rather, I guess, double agents working for the Soviets.
Wow. So, like, they were on the British side, but they were
getting British
from the Russian side?
Okay. They were British intelligence officers who were actually working for the Soviets, or... they were scholars and officers. I'm not totally up on my Cold War history, but they were working for the Russians the whole time.
Gotcha.
He was friends with one of them.
I believe that the reason for that is that he actually was recruited to MI6 early in his life by his sister Elizabeth. He was apparently posted in Sierra Leone during World War II, and there's a note that his supervisor and friend Kim Philby later turned out to be a Soviet agent.
Mm-hmm.
Graham Greene just sounded like he had a fascinating life. He grew up. He was British, and he dealt with bipolar disorder his entire life.
Oh.
And depression in particular. He apparently attempted suicide multiple times before the age of 16 and was, just had a very troubled youth. And then as an adult, he got into MI6 and it just ended up traveling the world constantly for almost his entire life. Like, he never spent more than a couple of weeks in any given place. He became friends with a lot of down and out types, revolutionaries. At one point he went to Cuba right after Castro's revolution and ended up helping the revolutionaries as a courier. His writing, as you mentioned, tended to have a lot of Catholic themes, and apparently for a long time he considered himself to have two genres that he referred to as entertainments and novels.
Okay.
And on the entertainment side, which he thought were kind of lighter and more frivolous, that was where he had those political thrillers, The Third Man sort of falling into that category. But then on the novel side, his literature side, they tended to be more philosophical, religious, spiritual, but even then, it wasn't like the kind of stuff you would find if you just went into the Christian section of Barnes and Noble. These tended to be about very like dark, seedy characters who were really struggling with their faith, and getting into a lot of turmoil on their path towards possible redemption. So he was really more interested in the dark side of human nature and the problem of evil rather than, just strict, like, worshiping and God is good and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. I mean, you can kind of see that in this.
Oh, absolutely. And there were definitely, knowing that about him, I definitely saw elements of that come through in the script. But as you mentioned, he had tons of affairs. He was a hard drinker, all those sorts of things. He was actually, it sounded like he was having his first affair at the time of the third man. Like, he had he'd started the affair in 46 and then left his family in 1947 right before starting work on the third man.
Okay.
So yeah, it's kind of a rough time for him. And then coincidentally, Alida Valli, the lead actress, had just divorced from her husband in 1949, and Wells, who had been married before, had just broken up with Weta Hayworth in 1947 and just left America entirely. So he was in Europe for the next like 10 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of, you know, among the people working on this, I think everybody was sort of in the mood for like a fresh start, which I thought was interesting, especially since it was right after World War II. And let's see, Carol Reed, apparently he was a British director. I mentioned that he had done a few other movies that were quite popular and ended up in the Criterion Collection. He ended up with working with Green because during his earlier movies, which were just, he was like just getting started in film, Green was working for a magazine reviewing films, and he was like the first person to take notice of Reed's films and start writing positive reviews of them from afar. And then they ended up both working for Alexander Korda, who was a famous British producer and studio owner. And then they also, just as an aside for anybody who's listened to the previous podcasts, he had, throughout World War II, he had all these tertiary connections with Hitchcock, because he worked with the screenwriters Launder and Gilliatt, who wrote The Lady Vanishes. And then he also had worked with Michael Redgrave and Robert Durnott, who were both in The Lady Vanishes and The 39 Steps. And even to the point that in the initial draft for The Third Man, do you remember the character Krabbins, who is the...
He's the propaganda guy.
Yes.
The cultural,
yeah, he sets up
attaché
the,
person.
Right. Exactly. That character in the first draft of the screenplay was the characters, was it Caldecott and, oh no, I can't think of it. I know I have it written down. There are these two, there was like a comedy buddy duo in The Lady Vanishes.
The cricket guys.
Yeah, the cricket guys.
They're supposed to be, so Krabbins was supposed to be those guys?
Yeah.
I'm glad they did not do that.
Oh, I'm really glad too, honestly. But I thought, you know, just funny coincidences here and there with all of these British actors and directors and so on.
Yeah.
Then we get to Alida Valli. I remember when I first saw her in this film in college, you know, I'd never heard of her, but she was she's wonderful in the movie. Mm-hmm. Strikingly beautiful.
She did
great
not,
acting.
No, she didn't have like a lot of acting experience prior to this, right?
Well, she did actually, but not necessarily in this kind of movie. She got her start at 13 years old in Italian film, because that's where she was from. Mm-hmm. So she was in all these Italian like light comedies throughout the 30s. And then coming off of that, she was in a movie called We the Living,
mm-hmm.
that was based on the Ayn Rand novel. And I actually saw that movie just recently for the first time. And she's, you know, regardless of what you think about the storyline and the writer and all that, she's fantastic. Easily the best part of the movie, in this very dark, World War II, World War I Russian communist film. So that I think that was like her first big dramatic role.
I am looking at her filmography, and I now apologize for saying she didn't have a lot of experience, because she'd been in like probably more movies than the rest of the top billed cast at this point. Yeah. So I was super wrong.
Exactly. And even with that, she was only 28 mm-hmm. at the time that The Third Man was made. I guess the end of that is just, if you have a chance, go see some more of her work, because she's wonderful. And she later, she was in Dario Argento's Suspiria, which I know is a famous horror movie.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and then in 1960, she was in a famous French horror movie called Eyes Without a Face. It was this like dark story about a mad scientist who wanted to give his daughter a face transplant after a horrible accident.
Yes, yeah, I've heard of that one. It's on the list.
Yep.
The list, my list. I don't think it's on the Criterion list, but
it is actually on Criterion DVD, not Laserdisc.
Not Laserdisc.
Yeah, I think that's how I ended up reading about it. It was like a random essay from the Criterion website. So, yeah, with that,
What's the movie about?
Rattled on enough. Yeah, what is the movie about? The gist of it is, what do we got? Holly Martins. He's an American writer of pulp novels, westerns, with great titles. Like, what was the shootout at the Double Eggs Ranch?
Yeah, Oklahoma Kid.
Yep.
The Lone Rider of Santa Fe.
Yes, actually, just, you know, top-end literature, as you can tell. And he shows up in Vienna, Austria, in 1949, I assume it's contemporary, and it's right after World War II, the city is still recovering, and it's controlled by four different countries, all have different parts of the city broken up. You know, who did you say they were?
The four sectors are the British, French, U.S. and the Russian sector.
Right. And he's there to meet up with his old friend Harry Lime, who he hasn't seen since, I think he said, 1939, so well before the war. And on his arrival, he's expecting Lime to meet him, but then finds out from the hotel staff that he's apparently dead. He just got hit by a car the other day, and his funeral is about to take place. But something about the details of the death seem a little off, and Holly starts investigating. And throughout the course of the movie, he just sort of unravels this mystery of where his friend is. And it's all based on the fact that the hotel porter informed him that he saw three men carrying Lime's body away, whereas only two men are accounted for by everybody else's story.
Yeah, so he's trying to figure out who the third man is.
Exactly. He ends up meeting Lime's girlfriend, who is Anna Schmidt. She is an actress. He witnesses her in some sort of Italian like operetta or something like that that's being played. German, I suppose. And he ends up falling in love with her. She does not reciprocate any of his feelings, poor guy. And the whole movie is about these, you know, sort of mistaken identities and unraveling the truth, because everybody seems to be lying. And eventually the third man does in fact turn up. And there's this great, really only lasts like 15 minutes or so of the film, where you see Orson Welles on screen.
Yeah, Harry turns out to be alive and deeply involved in a penicillin distribution racket, which has caused the death or insanity of dozens of people.
Yeah, which I read actually happened. Green based this on his initial research in Vienna and was informed by the police there about these sorts of things going on after the war.
Yeah. So this conspiracy finally unravels. There's a thrilling chase through the sewers where Lime has been hiding out in the Russian quarter, where he's been feeding information to the Russians. In order to, I suppose they're just turning a blind eye to his activities as long as he's still useful.
Yeah, makes sense.
And then eventually there's a shootout, and Harry perishes.
Yeah, by Holly's hand, his best friend. Or his best friend before the war, anyway.
Yep.
Yeah. So I'm going to turn it over to you now. Like, what would you... what struck you most about the film?
Well, what struck me most watching it was, again, like we talked about those Dutch angles and stuff. I still don't notice them. Like, I was looking for them.
Interesting.
I see them, but they don't strike me as unusual or like needlessly artistic or off-putting or anything. There's Dutch angles in a lot of horror movies. Like, I'm actually thinking about like the Evil Dead movies, and they're so jarring on purpose. I don't think that was a mistake that Sam Raimi made. They're meant to jar you, but it doesn't feel like that, because most of the Dutch angles appear when they're just kind of running around the streets and the sewers, and instead they just feel disorienting, and it really drives home that theme of like, oh, this is a kind of a fish out of water story at its
and I
core.
Like that about the I was looking for them too, just to remember, and really a lot of it is quite subtle in that, you know, they're using Dutch angles during like a conversation in a cafe between Calloway, the British police commander, and Holly, for instance.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel weird, because you just feel like that. It makes you feel more like it's almost a point of view shot, your head is canted, like you're naturally talking to someone. You know, you've just got your head at this angle where you're kind of slumped against a chair.
It also tends to highlight characters who seem to be not telling the truth, I noticed. Like, it'll straighten out when it goes to Holly sometimes, when he's like walking to a new location or thinking to himself or stuff like that, but then a character will get introduced and suddenly there's this subtle twist of the lens.
Yeah, it's so subtle, it's used so subtly that it's super effective, and it's communicating so much to you that you know, once again, your brain notices it, even if you don't. Something else that really stood out to me is that the camera is really static. There are very few camera movements. There's some basic, like, you know, pans to follow someone if they stand up and walk across the room or whatever. But there's only one big, like, kind of crane shot. And even that is extremely subtle.
What was that?
Towards the end, when Harry like appears in that bombed out building,
he
stands up, and you can kind of see the camera like crane towards the cafe.
His point. I made a note of that one too.
And that's really one of the only crane shots, and I don't know if that was just due to difficulties in shooting. But, like, I imagine it's not easy to put a camera on top of a building that has been bombed.
Yeah, no kidding.
And set up a crane on that.
And this was also on location as well, which is important to note, that almost the entire movie is actually shot in Vienna on the streets.
But it's hard to tell if that was a practical consideration, but really I just feel like everything was like storyboarded so tightly that they just kind of understood the movie that they wanted to make, and did not need to move the camera around much to make it.
I think that's helped by the director and the assistant director and the DP had all worked together on their previous film, The Fallen Idol. Yeah, so presumably they all had a very common language. You know, they knew how each other worked. They knew their thought processes, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I'm not sure what else to say. The lighting is excellent. Like, everything's just flooded with, like, key lights, like, everywhere.
Yeah.
Just shining through stuff. I wonder how much they spent on lights, actually, because, like, there's a lot of times where they're just sort of running towards, like a Dark Souls-ish, like, portal of light.
Yeah.
As they're framing.
Especially in the sewer.
Especially in the sewer, but, like, on the streets during all the chases. I don't know. It's great. I feel like, so I know Vince Gilligan, writer of, or creator, writer, showrunner, I don't know, involved with Better Call Saul, Breaking Bad, and, the bad seasons of the X-Files. this is among his favorite films, along with, Godfather 1 and 2 and 2001. One of the reasons I mentioned that is because this is almost for people with favorite films that are all, like, you know, among the classics, so to speak. This one seems like a deeper cut. Like, you'll hear lots of people say, like, oh, The Godfather is my favorite movie, or 2001 is my favorite movie, or Seven Samurai or Vertigo, all of these things that are, you know, supposed to be these classics. And that's not to disparage any of them. It's just interesting that among that school of thought, this is one of the less considered or more obscure greatest films of all time.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I have that perception.
I think
also, which is interesting, because even when it came out, it was, like, right off the bat, very well received. The critics loved it. It was a box office hit, and so on.
I wonder if that's because there's nothing particularly innovative about it. It's just extremely competently made.
Yeah, I suppose you could argue that.
Like you can feel 2001's influence in other movies. Up through,
right.
Up
it's through harder Star to see Wars. The influence from this one.
Exactly, because, like, I don't know what influence there is to take from it other than, hey, let's put together a story that's extremely tight with, like, great camera work and performances.
Yeah.
I think every movie should do that.
Yeah.
Like, that feels like the minimum bar for success for me is this is a great movie that's been put together by experts.
Indeed it is. I'm glad that they... I read Roger Ebert's 1996 review of the movie, and he mentioned that at the time they were considering remaking The Third Man. I'm really glad they didn't get around to that.
Me too. Oh, man. Yeah. 1996. With Ben Stiller as Harry Lime.
Well, now that you bring that up, actually, one of the notes I had was that the casting was interesting. Because when they were trying to figure it out in 1948, apparently Cary Grant originally agreed to star in the Holly Martin's role.
I can see that.
Actually it says he had agreed to star on condition that he could play either of the two male leads. So he could have been either way.
He should have done both.
Yeah, pulled an early Peter Sellers.
Yeah.
He ended up dropping out because the script wasn't finished, and he just felt like he didn't want to commit without a finished script.
Okay.
To know what he was getting into. So, the director, Carol Reed, ended up taking Joseph Cotten instead. It says reluctantly, because Cotten just happened to be, signed with David O. Selznick, who was producing the movie. So it was basically just out of convenience.
He owed him a picture.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's... And then, you know, Cotton's such a better, like, surly drunk than Cary Grant is.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. It's hard to imagine...
Cary Grant this grumpy.
Yeah. Grumpy and there's, like, disenchanted, maybe?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As, like, a sort of, he's just down and out. Like, he reminds me a little bit of, have you seen A Face in the Crowd?
No, but, you know, go on with your anecdote.
Walter Matthau is in that movie.
Oh, yeah, very okay. Early on. No, I'm familiar with Mr. Matthau's body of work.
Okay, yeah. And he plays a very similar type of writer. This just sort of grumpy, like, idealist who has been let down over and over again. It's also a Criterion release just recently on Blu-ray, oh, okay. So check that out. Eventually, Criterion will start paying me for these, I'm sure.
Yes. And then, of course, Orson Welles needed the money, as he always did.
Yes. But he was not actually the first choice.
Who was?
So there was a meeting early on with Selznick and Alexander Korda and Carol Reed, and I believe it was Reed who put forth Welles as an option, like he really wanted him, but Selznick wasn't sure, and so they ended up Selznick was really pushing for Noel Coward
to play the writer
to play Harry Lime.
I'm really not seeing that.
I know. He was pushing Noel Coward. They also considered David Niven, Robert Taylor, and Robert Mitchum.
Robert Mitchum, I can almost see, but Welles really makes right. The part his own. He actually
does.
This may be in your notes. He actually insists that he wrote all of his dialogue.
Yes, which is false, as usual.
As usual, he did, however, apparently write that monologue about the cuckoo clock. People do seem to back him up on that.
Even that, I'm not as positive, because when I read about it, there was a note that it sounded like at least part of that line was in a footnote in the original shooting script.
Well, welcome
written
to
by Green.
Welcome to our podcast. Orson Welles is a big fat liar.
Yes, I assume that will be the thesis of every episode that you and I make about Orson Welles movies.
Every time you have me on, it's just about that.
Absolutely. but it is a great line about the Romans...
The Italians under the Borgias, you had murder and death and tyranny, but you had Michelangelo and all of the Renaissance. And then in Switzerland, they had brotherly love and democracy. And what'd they get? The cuckoo clock. And then at this point, we are obligated by the Swiss government to say, of course, that the cuckoo clock was not invented in Switzerland.
It was not. It was invented by the Germans,
mm-hmm.
as it turns out. just briefly, let's talk about the music, which is maybe one of the most famous things about this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what did you find out about Karas? Was that his name?
Yeah, Anton Karas or Karas. I'm really not sure of the pronunciation, so I apologize. Was discovered, as the legend goes, by the cast. He was just playing zither in a beer garden. And Carol Reed said, "That's it. I want that in my picture." And no one he was with spoke German, so he got some of the other diners to translate for him. And eventually, Anton agreed. And the third man theme like topped the charts for the next year or so.
Yeah, I read half a million copies of the theme had been sold by the end of 1949, so not even the next year.
It's a very catchy tune. It was my ringtone for several years, in fact.
Mm-hmm. It is very catchy.
Yeah, I think even when we were in school together, I believe that was my ringtone at the time.
Yeah, I believe that. I also found that Karas, the musician, so he went to Carol Reed's house actually during editing and stayed at his house to come up with the all of the music for the film. They would just watch the rough cut together and come up with the music. And after the success of the theme song, this guy who had just prior to this been, you know, practically a busker on the street, he ends up very rich. He's performing for, like, celebrities, royalty. Princess Margaret invites him to the Empress Club, where he plays twice a week. He plays in front of Pope Pius XII, all sorts of stuff. And in 1954, opened his own wine bar, which became a tourist attraction, and was frequented by Orson Welles.
That's the dream, right? Like,
yeah.
First, you get discovered, then you play in front of emperors and popes, and then finally you've got the scratch to open a bar.
Absolutely. It's the dream life. Yeah. Well, just before we wrap up, I'm curious about your take on, you know, this is a very, it's a tight film, as you said, very well constructed, pretty straightforward mystery noir sort of plot. Do you find that there are any deeper meanings to the plot or the characters?
You know, I've never really allowed myself to think about deeper meanings. Knowing what I...
Just in general?
Yeah. No, in general, ever, no. Knowing what I know about Graham Greene, like, it feels like this guy had an interesting life. And... Mm. That he was really, really talented at synthesizing things that he'd pulled from all kinds of areas into a story.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I haven't really thought much about themes or anything. It's just there's this constant kind of running thing of betrayal, as Wells notes in. He says something to the effect of, I'm going to paraphrase because I think I'll actually do a better job at this than he does in his book. In the book, This is Orson Welles, again, the series of interviews with Peter Bogdanovich. He alludes to the fact that he didn't have to work hard at this part because every line of dialogue in the film is about him.
Mm. About him as a person or him as a character?
About Harry Lime.
Oh, okay.
Just every single line of dialogue in the film is about Harry Lime. Just about.
Yeah.
So everyone has their own sort of idea of who Harry is. He's this gangster, or he's my lover, or he's my best friend. And Harry does not give two shits about anybody who's not Harry Lime. In the end, and that's very affecting. That scene in the Ferris wheel when he finally reveals that.
Yeah, absolutely. He's talking about the. I mean, he sounds like a sociopath. Like he's just pointing at all the strangers on the street and saying, "If I handed you $20,000, knowing that some of those dots down there would stop moving forever, would you really turn me down, old man?
Or would you start counting the dots?"
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, thematically, it's interesting the way that we remember people after they've passed. Like, everyone seems to romanticize him except for Calloway.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's...
Have you seen...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't know if that's the sort of thing you're after, but, like, it starts with this movie sort of bookended with funerals or death. And so, like, I guess it's about the way we remember people and how everyone has this sort of secret internal life, and we very rarely get to call that into question after they've passed.
Mm. Yeah, that is the kind of thing that I was wondering about. I hadn't quite even thought about those lines so much. It reminds me of, have you seen Ikiru by Kurosawa?
No, I haven't.
Oh, that's it's another movie that involves, that's the whole theme, is remembering a person after they have died, and everybody debating like how to sum up that person's life, based on their memories of the person, and then of you eventually find out that it was even more complicated than that, because of course everybody is. And I think that has a lot to, like, what I had written down was that there is a lot of moral ambiguity in this film,
and up until the point where there absolutely is not.
Yes, which I think is important. But I think, you know, aside from the writer's own journey in his spirituality and his faith, and also, you know, exploring darkness and stuff like that, it feels very much of its time in terms of being only a couple of years after the end of World War II. And I think there's a lot of, like, kind of a loss of innocence involved in the story. And what I saw was that you've got Holly from America, and Limes is American as well, right? They're both supposed, not just, yes, American actors, but they're American characters.
Yes,
right. I just think it seems to be a lot about how something as insane and absurd as a world war changes people, because Holly is still holding on to these old sort of naive views of the world, you know, what he remembers of his friend, and he writes these, you know, just kind of fluff novels and things like that, and he's going abroad just to meet his friend, and then he's confronted with all of this darkness, like the city is controlled by four competing forces. It's the beginning of the Cold War. Everybody's lying to each other. Like, you're not sure who to trust. And what was...
I mean, there's that.
You said something that was really interesting.
Holly realizes this is who Harry's always been during their confrontation.
Yes.
And it takes that for him to put it in perspective. He says, hey, remember when the police raided that gambling parlor? You knew a safe way out, but only for you.
Yeah. Well, but that, I guess that's sort of, that still fits with what I'm attempting to get at, which is that Holly, like, this is very, you know, armchair psychoanalysis, but to me...
Yeah, no, I think a loss of innocence is yeah, reflected.
And I think specifically with Holly's character.
Yes.
Like, it's almost like a coming-of-age tale in a way, in that he's... You mentioned fish out of water, mm-hmm, for Holly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, just him, like, being confronted with the real world of, you know, your friend isn't who you thought he was, and... there are, like, darker forces at work here. And I think with...
I was going to say, one of the other things I really enjoy about this movie is Holly's investigation is so careful. And he's not doing anything particularly, like, inventive, but he continually catches people in lies, and he just remembers everything he's ever heard. Like you would need to if you're a pulp writer. You just need to be able to be pulling in information constantly, because, like, anything you hear or any conversation you have might save you a day of work, like on a paragraph of a story.
Yeah.
And so it feels very credible, and one of the reasons why this movie, I think, maintains tension so well is you, the audience, are moving at kind of the same pace as him. Like, when he catches someone in a lie, if you're paying attention, you did too at that exact same moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like an Agatha Christie where you're supposed to kind of, like, be trying to stay ahead of the sleuth, right? Like,
right.
Part of the joy in those kind of mystery novels is figuring things out ahead of time, or if the writer is a dirty, cheating bastard, they have withheld some information from you deliberately so that that it makes the sleuth look smarter than you, the reader. Mm-hmm. But no, you're really moving at the same pace as Holly the whole time.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Just good, as we said, good, well-crafted movie and story.
Yep, it's a good film, competently made.
Well, now that we've discussed probably every last detail of this movie, do you know if it had any influences or sort of later works based on it? Anything like that?
Why, John, I'm glad you asked. As you know, Harry Lime is Joe Pesci's character in Home Alone, which is undoubtedly the most important influence of this movie.
And that's it, actually.
And that's all.
Zero other references in the rest of pop culture.
I know they used the third man theme in an episode of Better Call Saul. There's sort of a montage at the nursing home when Jimmy McGill is still practicing elder law. And that's probably a nod to that being one of Vince Gilligan's favorite films.
Sure.
There was a radio drama, The Adventures of Harry Lime, which reportedly has a slightly lighter tone than this movie. I imagine it would have to. Several of the scripts were collected and put into a book of short stories. They were turned into, you know, short stories and collected into a book called The Lives of Harry Lime, which I would like to find a copy of someday. Yeah.
Have you heard any of the broadcast?
No. It's all like prequel stuff. I would like to see if some of that is on YouTube. Maybe if we find one, we'll put a link in. A lot of those are in public domain. I don't know about this particular series being in public domain, but a lot of those old radio dramas are. So there's a better than average chance that we could put a link to some in the description to this. Evidently, scripts for the Third Man series were being paid at $1,000 per script, which is pretty good. Mm-hmm. Especially, I mean, that's good now, but like for the time, that sounds great. Yeah. Wells heard about that, and because he's perennially broke, he said, "Yeah, okay, I'll do six of them. Give me $6,000." After the scripts were delivered, like some time later, the person who had ghostwritten them under Wells's name said, "Hey, where's my $6,000?" So Wells had simply taken the check and pocketed the money. According to legend, when he confronted about it, he said, "Don't pay him. They weren't very good scripts." This anecdote is taken from actually an interview on the Mr. Arcade and Criterion DVD.
Gotcha. Well, and I know the one of that DVD also has a couple of the radio broadcasts on it.
Yep. And one other minor thing. If you're a comic book fan, Harry Lime features prominently into some storylines for the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen once that gets into the 50s.
Okay.
Where Harry serves as M for MI6, you know, James Bond's boss.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was also part of the Big Brother Ingsoc regime, because that series also assumes that the events of 1984... took place. So he was part of that regime, and then once it collapsed, he just transitioned seamlessly into MI6.
Of course he did. He plays all sides.
He does. He plays one side, but his own.
Oh, yeah, good point.
So, John, does this movie belong in the Criterion Collection?
Yes, absolutely. So much more than The Lady Vanishes, I have to say. Sorry to keep harping on that movie.
No, it's okay. You know, sometimes you don't like a movie.
Yeah.
Boy, I gotta, you know, let's hear that mission statement again.
Okay.
Before I can give an answer. Well,
their mission is to release important classic and contemporary films on home video.
So this is where this is tough for me. Is this movie important?
Okay.
Is this movie excellent? Yes. Is it still one of my favorites? Yeah. Important though. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, you're already starting to convince me, and I feel silly.
I got you.
Yeah.
Other than, like, you know, this is a favorite movie for a lot of people. It's on a lot of lists of greatest films ever made. This movie seems similar to Casablanca in that way, right?
Okay.
It's just it's a very tightly put together piece of filmmaking.
Yep.
By very competent people who are masters of their craft. And I don't know. Maybe it is enough for you know, maybe a movie becomes important if enough people like it. Like, it's kind of like the Mona Lisa in that respect, right? Like,
sure.
There are other better paintings, but that one got famous partially just by, like, hanging around. And it got stolen a couple times. That helped.
That helped. But do you think it's, if enough people like it over time?
I don't know.
Because, like, you know, Avatar was wildly successful, but I don't know that
we'll I don't be know a single person who's
reviewing
seen that
it
movie.
50 years from now.
I have never met anyone who's seen Avatar.
Really?
Name one person.
I can't.
I got you. Yeah, no.
I just remember everybody talking about
it. Here's the thing. Everyone talked about it. Nobody saw it, and it still made $1 billion. I don't understand Avatar.
The whole thing was a tax dodge.
It's a money laundering scheme.
Probably. Well, okay, so maybe
the only person who saw Avatar was one guy named Big Frankie who saw it 50,000 times.
Well, but do you think, you know, if there's a movie that is the highest grossing box office success of its year, but then nobody talks about it 20 years later, was it important?
No, I would, for the same reason I would say, like, Back to the Future is a more important movie than Out of Africa, which won Best Picture.
That year, right.
So, yeah, it's hard to say. I guess... Yes, tentatively, depending on how you define important, it belongs in the collection.
Mm-hmm.
But if you define importance as advancing the craft of filmmaking, I don't know if it does.
Well, I think that's excellently argued.
Okay.
And again, I
love this movie. I will defend it to my dying breath. I'm not arguing against its inclusion on any, like, you know, Armageddon is also in the Criterion Collection, and we'll get to that.
That we will.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, with that, I will wrap things up here. Thank you so much for being here with me today, Theron.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah, and hopefully I will. I think I've got you scheduled a few episodes from now for yet another Orson Welles film, if I remember.
Which one is that? Is that Amberson's?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, that's great. I've never seen Amberson's. I'm really looking forward to it.
Great. It will be an interesting time. Well, thank you to the audience for listening to another one of these. And next episode, we will have our first musical. It is called Swing Time with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. Stay safe, everybody, and healthy. And
remain indoors.
And indoors, please. Don't forget to support your libraries.